Hello and welcome to Hindsight here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. We're going back to the 19th century today, when Europeans were taking to the sea in big sailing ships headed for the Great South Land. So many of these sea voyages ended in disaster. Shipwrecks were common enough to be a source of great fear for travellers. In this program, we explore four stories of being shipwrecked and cast away along the Great Barrier Reef in North Queensland, and the stories of the relationships that grew between the castaways and their Indigenous rescuers. These stories were first brought together by Ian McCalman in his recent book, The Reef, A Passionate History. The producer is Nicole Steinke.
The preserved meat had all run out. A few days after this, the first man died. As soon as he died, he was stripped and thrown over the side, the sharks devouring him instantly. The sucking child of Mrs. Wilmot was next to die, and shortly afterwards the other little girl, and next to her, Mrs. Wilmot herself. At this time they dropped off one after the other very rapidly, but I was so exhausted myself that I forgot the order of their names.
Shipwrecked. The year is 1846. Finally, the survivors reach shore. There are six of them, but two die beside a waterhole, too weak to search for food. Cast away more than 1,000 kilometres from the nearest European settlement, they're rescued by the local Indigenous people. James Morrow lives with his Birriggaba rescuers for 17 years.
After we'd been 14 days on the shore, we were seen by some of the natives. For several nights they had observed falling stars in one particular direction, the direction of the rocks on which we were. They have a superstition about falling stars. They think that they point out the direction of a hostile tribe. But something possessed the minds of these black fellows, and they bent their steps in the direction the stars fell.
Morrell says they were treated kindly, but the life was hard, and his companions died. Eventually, only he was left. He learned the local language and customs, and for 17 years lived as an Aboriginal man. He rejoined white society at the time when the British were forcibly pushing into northern Queensland, bringing their guns and their cattle. Some of his adopted clan were killed in early encounters. This is just one of the castaway and rescue tales we'll be hearing today. There's also a young Scottish woman named Barbara Thompson, who lived for 5 years on an island off the tip of Cape York.
I farewell, alas, forever, deep in heartfelt tears.
And 14-year-old French cabin boy Narcisse Pelletier, who, like James Morrell, lived with his rescuers for 17 years. He only left them at gunpoint. The British sailors holding the guns on his adopted family thought they were rescuing him. From the 17th century, shipwreck and castaway stories, both real and imagined, excited the public mind in Europe. The most famous was Robinson Crusoe, a story that ends happily.
When I was on the shore, I fell on my knees and gave God thanks for my deliverance. I was now at a great loss which way to get home with my boat. I had run so much hazard and knew too much the cause to think of attempting it by the way I went out.
And what might be. But there were also many tales of cannibalism and captivity. It was the age of exploration and conquest, and there was only one way to do it: by ship.
In the Surrey dock one day, the mate knew that it was time to get underway. Stormy weather, boys, stormy weather, boys, when the wind blows, our barge will go.
It is true that most sailors loathed the sea, oddly enough. That's a background we need to know, because people fear the sea. Very few people can swim from the British part of the world. The sea is a place of horror. So I think the idea of being a castaway, or of being shipwrecked is one of the kinds of nightmares that anybody who's going to travel across the oceans has to deal with.
Professor Ian McCallman from the University of Sydney is author of The Reef, A Passionate History. He claims Lieutenant, later Captain, James Cook, and the crew of the Endeavour were this continent's first recorded castaways.
The interesting thing about Cook and the Great Barrier Reef is that you can see Cook in an entirely different light from the way that we generally see him, which is as the great explorer, you know, who brought half a hemisphere into the hands of Britain. He is the first, he and his men are the first castaways of the southern hemisphere. His ship hit a coral reef they didn't know was there. They didn't realize they were in the Great Barrier Reef. They never would. And they had sailed in what we now know as the Barrier Reef Lagoon for 800 kilometers. And then suddenly in the middle of the night, they hit a reef. And the boat looks as though it's going to go down. Cook is absolutely certain they will be confronted with one or two fates, either that the ship will be smashed to pieces and they will drown, or, he said, worse, we will be marooned and facing what they would likely believe to be very hostile, possibly head-hunting savages.
Instead, Cook and his crew encountered the clan of traditional custodian Alberta Hornsby. Ian McCallman recorded this interview with Alberta while he was working on his book, The Reef. They're sitting on a windy headland overlooking the Endeavour River at what's now Cooktown.
One of the things that I've learnt about this area was that it was considered to be a free zone.
Oh.
And it meant that this place was a special place that people from surrounding clan lands would come and meet. It was a place of mediation.
Ah.
It was a place where initiations took place. Right. One of the laws was prohibiting the spilling of blood on this land.
It's incredible to think that, well, Cook lucked out, didn't he? I mean, he really did. He had no idea of any of this.
My uncle Eric always says that if he had landed on that other side, the story may have been different.
Nevertheless, there's violence. A dispute erupts over scarce resources, green turtle.
Cook and Banks and his men had every intention of living peacefully with these people. But that was not his first concern. When Cook went ashore, his first concern, of course, was, is the boat repairable? It proves to be repairable. His next concern is, how the hell will we get out of here? Because he goes up a mountain and he sees that he is absolutely surrounded by coral reefs. It's like something he's never seen before. And he and Banks coin the term, the labyrinth. They're in a labyrinth. He does not know how they're going to leave, and he has another problem because a number of his men have scurvy, and they will die unless they can get fresh vegetables and fresh meat. So that's his first concern, and what he hopes with the locals is that he can trade with them, as you're able to do in the South Pacific. You give them some beads and some gewgaws, as he used to call them, and they will in turn give you this fresh food. And that proves really difficult. The tribes are very wary, and when they do eventually connect up with them and they give them these gifts, they look at them in derision, really, and throw them away. So he can't get fresh vegetables or fish or anything else from them. And that is a crisis. It's a crisis of a castaway. And the crisis is resolved by sheer chance. One of his men is out there trying to find a channel, and he goes up onto one of the reefs offshore from Cooktown, from Endeavour River, and sees all these enormous 200-pound green turtles basking in the sun. And they grab them, 13 of these turtles. They put them on their boat and they celebrate because it's obvious, Banks says, that we are now saved.
Oh,
They can keep turtles alive. They can take them with them on the voyage, you know. They're just wallowing in riches. That's how Banks said. What they didn't realise, of course, was that these turtles belonged to the indigenous people of the district as they saw it. It's part of their country. They know that they're there. I mean, they can go and get them any time. 13 turtles on one ship is absolutely exceptional. I mean, it's a huge quantity. It will be keep the local clans for months in food.
It would have been very difficult for our people to get meat, you know, with using spears and the implements that they did use in hunting. And turtles, one of the food sources, a great gourmet delight for indigenous people.
Yes.
But interestingly, Ian, what I thought was very interesting, that it was not the traditional time for turtle hunting. You know, there was only 6 months of the year where turtles were hunted.
And so they actually come to the ship. They send what we would now reckon to be a kind of delegation. It's 10 naked men with spears. And they come up in a canoe and they come up to the ship and they make it very clear that they want at least one turtle. And they refuse. They manhandle these blokes away. They push them away. Cook offers them bread and they throw the bread on them. They don't want bread. They don't know what bread is. So eventually, angered, they jump into their boat, go across to the shore and set fire to the grass where the men have tents and things on the shore. So Cook orders one of his men to fire and they hit one of these men. The blood is quite clearly seen and the rest run away.
You know, we can understand that Cook needed to replenish his supplies, but it was interesting that of all the turtles they had, the Bama only wanted one.
That's true.
They all only wanted one turtle.
That's true.
Now we are ready to head for the horn. Way, hey, roll and go.
The boots and our clothes, boys, are all in the pond.
Simply rolling in Randy, Randy, oh, heave a ball, heave away. Way, hey, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cable's all stowed. To me rolling in Randy, Randy, oh.
The most famous castaway in these waters was Eliza Fraser, the poster girl for British claims of Aboriginal barbarity. Her hotly contested tale of 5 weeks' slavery in Aboriginal hands was lurid and sensational and made her a lot of money. But most castaway stories were nothing like Eliza's. For instance, Barbara Thompson's. In 1844, the young Scotswoman was shipwrecked with her new husband off the tip of Cape York. Her husband drowned, but a group of local turtle hunters in canoes came across Barbara floating in the wreckage. They pulled her from the water. She lived with them for 5 years. Emma Dortons is a historian with a baby in her lap, you'll hear the baby, whose PhD topic was cross-cultural friendships in Australia. That's how she views Barbara Thompson's relationship with her Carrareg rescuers, as a friendship.
I think she found them to be compassionate, good-humoured, patient, and developed really strong relationships, partly because she's a working-class woman. She didn't have any sense of her own superiority or anything like that, unlike someone like Eliza Fraser, who was the captain's wife when she was wrecked on the Stirling Castle on Fraser Island and was not going to make friends with the women who rescued her. Barbara Thompson saw eye to eye and didn't have any sense of her superiority, and there was no barrier in that way to having just developing strong relationships.
Aside from being a ripping yarn, part of the appeal of this story is the way it unfolds in the private journals of Oswald Brearley, a cultural observer and artist. Brearley was one of the young men on board the HMS Rattlesnake as it headed slowly north with frequent stops to record flora and fauna and engage with the local people. Associate Professor Bronwyn Douglas from ANU is the author of Science, Voyages and Encounters in Oceania, 1511 to 1850.
The story of Barbara Thompson as told by Brearley is an extraordinary one, and Brearley himself really does break the mould. His sympathy for Thompson, more than that, his sympathy for the Aboriginal people, his readiness to go out amongst them unarmed. This is 1849. It's quite early in an area where they hadn't had much contact. His constant use of the term, my friends, I don't think he uses the term savage. And Barbara, who turns up, she's illiterate, she's naked, she's sunburned, she's injured, she's Scottish. And he is, I mean, he's a gentleman. He's not aristocratic, but he's certainly well-heeled.
With Thomas Huxley and John McGilvray, Brearley was a member of the scientific party on board the Rattlesnake, and he had plenty of free time when the ship was at sea. Over a period of weeks, he takes down Barbara Thompson's story in her own distinctive voice. Here she's describing appearing naked on the shore, where the crew of the Rattlesnake are washing their clothes. She's accompanied by Aboriginal friends.
Poor old Tammy was behind me, all trembling, afraid every minute that he was going to be shot. I think some of the men asked where I was from. I said I was from Moralug. They wanted to know if I'd been wrecked or taken by the blacks. I told them I'd been wrecked and pointed out Tom Ogogo to them and told them he was my brother and he'd saved my life. They asked me if I was from England or Ireland or Scotland. I told them I was a Scottish girl and that my father and my mother were in Sydney. Then some of them called out to another man, I think his name was Scott. Scott, Scott, come here. There's a Scotch girl. Scott took hold of my hand and led me along to where the men were washing. I could not understand the other men as I could him. When we reached the washing place, he took me into the bush with another man, washed me and combed my hair and dressed me in two shirts. I was so ashamed when I got to the washing place that I didn't notice what men were there. As I went along, I could hardly speak for crying.
And Brearley, day after day, gently investigated her story and took down every word. You know, he'd read them back to her and change anything that she said was wrong. So in the end, we have in the Mitchell Library now something like 30 volumes in extraordinary detail, the life of a Kurereg woman and the life of these Torres Strait Islander people just at the cusp of European contact.
Ian McCalman. Brearley never polished Barbara's story for publication. It only exists in his original notes, and some of its richness comes from seeing on his handwritten pages, full of scribbles and additions, how the story unfolds each day between them. Emma Dortons.
While Brearley talked to Barbara about her story, her family continued to visit her at the same time. So in his journals, you get a real interwoven account where Barbara's telling her story and he writes down not just what she says, but who was present at the time, what the atmosphere was like. And he writes down bilingually, English and Kaurig language, whether he understands it or not. So he's created this incredible resource almost beyond his own understanding that people have been able to, you know, gain from more recently, even though he didn't understand everything he wrote down.
An old man died when most of the people and all of the canoes were away at Cape York. He died one morning at the end of the wet season. I was sickly with the dupu, that's ague.
And it's an amazing archive. And it's an amazing story of how rich and complex the Indigenous life was on the Barrier Reef at that time.
As soon as Pithegasu was dead, they had a great cry for him and all put white clay on their bodies and threw themselves on the ground. The women cut their grass petticoats off and threw them away. His daughter cut her hair off. Everybody cried. They asked me why I did not come out and cry, and I said, I have the dupu. I'm quite as sorry as if I had the clay upon me. Then they said, your people are like ghosts. They don't cry. They have no feeling. We are people. Garkiji, we cry. I told them white people did not cry in that way.
She was clearly always different to the Aboriginal people. She didn't have to fulfil all a woman's roles. She was treated very kindly by them. She too was regarded as a returning spirit. But she doesn't seem to have been integrated. I mean, she was only 5 years as against 17. She's retained, but she's kept at arm's length within the society. There are certain things she doesn't know about, doesn't talk about, but she gives a really vivid account of what she does know. And Brearley's role as amanuensis is quite extraordinary. And, of course, we have his notes, so we can read the process by which he becomes more and more familiar, his additions, his parentheses, as he understands her better and gets a better grasp of the things she's talking about. And his interest in her is the personal one. He likes her. They all like her. They keep her away from the crew, which is pretty funny when you consider that she spent 5 years, you know, amongst savages, and yet they, although, again, Brearley doesn't use that word. McGilvray does all the time. So does Huxley.
Bronwyn Douglas. Huxley was to become the great defender of Charles Darwin and the theory of evolution. At the time, the evolutionists believed Aboriginal Australians ranked very low on the human ladder. Brearley obviously didn't believe that. Neither did Barbara Thompson.
One of the stories that I liked, where she's quite feisty, she's cooking some yams and she wants to put them in another woman's oven. And she doesn't ask in the right way. She just bungs them in. And the other woman, Yuri, gets agitated because she hasn't followed the correct etiquette, and she threw a shell at Barbara. Barbara fills it up with water and throws it back. Yuri goes and gets a stick to whack her with, and Barbara grabs a hair from behind and gives her a slap across the face. And then the rest of the family hops up and intervenes, and they say, come on, Yuri, you can't do this to Barbara. She's a stranger. She can't be expected to know everything. We've got to be nice to her. So I thought that was a really interesting little story which encapsulates some of the tensions, some of the difficulties of learning the new etiquette and customs.
None of the people took her part. They called out to me, strike, Guillaume, strike. They said I was a stranger amongst them and that Yuri shouldn't hurt me. Her daughter stood by and didn't say anything. She was a great friend of mine. And old Parkway took up his hoopy, his bamboo beheading knife, and tore a strip off the edge with his teeth and would have cut her head off, but they held him back. I was named after his daughter who had died just before I came amongst them. He said, why did Yuri strike this child who had only just come back to him? Yuri never said anything to me after this about it. She became a good friend and would take me out with her to dig the roots.
Barbara Thompson left on board the Rattlesnake in late 1849, heading for Sydney. Little is known about her after that, except that she lived a long life. Meanwhile, the British began to claim the far north of Cape York, and only 20 years after Barbara left, most of her Carrareg rescuers were massacred. Those who survived scattered. Eventually, they returned to their island homes, but in 1900, the Queensland government forcibly removed the Carrareg twice. In 1940, they once more returned. And in 2001, after years of struggle, they won native title over their lands. You're listening to Hindsight on RN and Castaway.
The first sea that struck her lifted the ship partly on the rock and swept one of the boats and the second mate overboard. The next seat lifted her wholly on top of the rocks, where she stuck fast. We now had one longboat left, but no sooner was she put over the side than the spray and broken water filled her.
Essex sailor James Morrell. The year is 1846. The captain and crew of the Peruvian made a raft big enough for around 20 people. Six reached shore alive. Two died soon after, too weak to look for food. The remaining four were luckier.
After we'd been 14 days on the shore, we were seen by some of the natives. They were as afraid of us as we were of them. But presently, when we held out our hands in supplication to them to help us, some of them returned the gesture.
It is very surprising that Jem Morrell's story hasn't received wider circulation. One has to assume that people really didn't want to hear good stories about Aboriginal people.
Ian McCalman, author of The Reef, A Passionate History.
Because Jem Morrell's story was a good news story about Aboriginal people. He had been shipwrecked off Horseshoe Reef, off the Great Barrier Reef. There were four of them left in a very debilitated condition, and they were found by a small group of Aboriginal men. About 20 had found them and looked after them.
They then gave us some small roots to eat, about the size of small marbles, which we enjoyed very much. They pointed to our stomachs to make us understand they knew we were hungry, and to their own, that they had plenty. They also pointed to the bush to tell us if we came with them, they would give us plenty to eat and drink. On our signifying our intention to go with them, they were very glad and wanted us to join them in a corroboree. But as we could not, we thought we should please them by singing a hymn. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform.
Jem Morrell was looked after by a particular tribe, the Bindal. The other people died very early. It was still a very tough life that Aboriginal people led. Jem Morrell was a big, burly man of 22, a strong sailor. Nevertheless, he himself had his knee badly bitten on one occasion by a crocodile, and he was bitten by a whip snake and blew right up. So it certainly wasn't an easy life, but he became a member of this Bindal clan and a very competent fender for himself.
Thanks to being shipwrecked and spending 17 years with the Birrigubba, Morrell also became known as the first settler of northern Queensland.
My name is Anne Wills. I'm co-author of a document on James Morrell, the first white settler of North Queensland.
My name is Dillis Maltby. Anne and I both worked on this together.
We are researchers at the Bowen Historical Society and Museum, Inc.
To me, he must have been a very brave man to have survived those 17 years with the Aborigines. His life wouldn't have been easy. It would have been very hard. Mm. And he suffered a lot. He had rheumatism very badly, and it must have been so difficult for him to get used to their ways and their food. I think he would have to be very careful that he didn't do anything wrong and offend them. Otherwise, they could have killed him too. And I think it would have taken a long time for him to learn their language, to make himself understood. And I think he was like a hero to get through all of that.
There were a few twists and turns along Morrell's path to life as a Birrigubba man. Historian Emma Dorton's PhD thesis delves deep into that story.
After only about 2 years, the captain and his wife and the cabin boy all died, leaving James Morrell as the only survivor of the Peruvian.
Why did the captain, his wife and the cabin boy die?
Don't know. When James Morrell was telling his story later on, the question was the other way around for people who were listening to his story. How did he survive? Whereas it was obvious to them why the other three had died, because they were
buried alive in this uncivilized culture. They must have wished to get back to their former lives and been unable to, and sickened and died. What wasn't obvious to them was how James Morrell had survived.
I believe the death of the boy preyed upon his mind, and also the degraded state of his wife. And the thought of her having come so low was too much for him. He sunk under it. I saw he could not last long, and I told them not to burn him, but to bury him in the ground, which they did.
So he lived with that group of people for many, many years as an adopted Birriggubba man, you know, learning the language, learning how to make a contribution economically. He said in his published narrative that he'd learned how to snare waterfowl in the swamps really well, and that was a contribution that he made to their economy and dinner table. He was absolutely astounded when he found that it had been 17 years. He said he couldn't believe that it had been half that long.
I lived on year after year in the tribe as one of themselves, nothing particularly happening. On one occasion, when I was on Mount Elliot looking for honey and breadfruit, which was not quite ripe, a report was brought to me that a vessel was seen on the coast at Cape Cleveland, where our raft had landed.
It's such an opaque and pregnant sentence. I mean, so much must have happened to him in that time. He must have had friendships and, you know, love, difficult seasons and good seasons and really exciting ceremonies, and all sorts of things must have happened, but nothing particularly happening. I think it's partly because all those other events weren't events that were relevant to the colonists who he was telling his story to, but it's really hard to tell how he felt about being a Birriggubba man. And there's a few asides in there that he was looking for ochre one day to paint up with for a ceremony. Another time where he'd missed seeing some cattle in the area because he was with his brother-in-law making a possum skin rug. A few little asides like that to indicate that he was part of, you know, close relationships.
But not close enough to make him want to stay.
What happened really was that he started to see Europeans arriving. It's the beginning of the great invasion of Queensland. People moving north, taking the land and bringing with them cattle and sheep and setting up huge farms, or British people would understand them, we would say pastoral leases. And so he's starting to see Europeans around him, and he's starting to feel drawn in a way towards his own people. And so eventually he makes this overture.
I shortly heard of the cattle being on the river in great numbers and of a man being on horseback with a stock whip, which he cracked. They thought it was a gun, on hearing which they got up into the trees quite frightened. They described to me that there were so many cattle that they had drunk all the water that was in the waterhole. Hearing this, I was anxious to find the white settlement, for I felt sure there was one not very far off. But having been with the blacks for so long, they were not willing to let me go, telling me I should be mistaken for a blackfellow. The next news I heard was of 15 blackfellows in a fishing party belonging to the tribe I was living with being shot down dead. I told them it served them right, that if they'd let me go to the white men, I might be the means of saving their lives. They reasoned among themselves, and they agreed that what I said was true.
Some of his brothers in the tribe had been shot and killed, and he was very mindful of the fact that it was risky to come to this settlement hut. So he tried to wash himself. He found a waterhole, and because he was naked, and he was probably very, very dirty. Somebody said, "Here is a red or a yellow man standing on the rails of the fence naked. He is not a black man. Bring the gun."
They are shooting Indigenous people left, right and centre, his friends and his connections. And he says, "Do not shoot. I am a British object." And they don't shoot. And they eventually persuade him to go back to his people as a kind of ambassador.
Frontier violence between settlers and the Aboriginal people in Queensland resulted in more than 10,000 Aboriginal deaths. Some place the number at 30,000. The local people weren't passive in the face of invasion. Europeans died too. And these shepherds were hoping they could use a strange white black man to negotiate. But they didn't fully trust him.
When I left them, I went back to the hills, to the blacks, and they began to surround me and ask me whether I had seen the white people and how many there were. I was obliged to tell that there were a great many people, many more than themselves, and plenty of guns, and that if they went near, they would be killed. I told them the white men had come to take their land away. They always understood that might, not right, is the law of the world, but they told me to ask the white man to let them have all the ground to the north of the Burdekin, ground which is no good to white people, near the seacoast and swampy, and to let them fish in the rivers. They asked me what I intended to do. I told them I was going to stay that night, but in the morning I must go back, or they would come and track me and shoot us all. They then said, "You will forget us altogether." And when I was coming away, the man I was living with burst out crying. So did his djinn, and several of the other djinns and men. It was a touching scene. The remembrance of their past kindness came full upon me and quite overpowered me. There was a short struggle between the feeling of love that I had for my old friends and companions and the desire once more to live a civilized life. I left them then and came on to the hut.
His audiences were huge. They were actually crowded onto the wharf at Brisbane, craning their necks to get a sight of him when he came in. He was quite a celebrity. It was partly because there was already a really lively literary tradition around castaway narratives.
Yes, he was a celebrity. We had a new governor. We had a new state. That was 1859. He met the governor. He met the mayor of Brisbane. And when he died, 2.5 years after he came back to Caucasian civilization, the flags were lowered, businesses closed, half the town went to his funeral. Yes, he was very much a celebrity and very much loved, apparently.
But I asked my son, who's over 40 now, did he know who James Morrill was? He didn't know who James Morrill was.
As Dilla said, it's not in the hearts of the Ballonites. But he was special. And the tribe he stayed with was special because they were so kind to him.
Anne Wills and Dilla Smallby from the Bowen Historical Society. You won't find any of James Morrill's descendants in Bowen today, but you will find people who bear his name. The story is that when the violence was at its height, a white farmer gave the name as a gift to his black servant Bessie and her new husband Billy. Nobody knows whether it was the name that kept them safe, but Bessie and Billy survived and had 3 sons. Their descendants still live in Bowen today. Now to our final castaway, and the youngest, Narcisse Pelletier. He was 8 years old when he first put to sea as a cabin boy, and he was only 14 in 1857 when, injured, he's abandoned by his captain and crew to die beside a dried-up waterhole. And strangely enough, like James Morrill, Pelletier also lived with his rescuers for 17 years.
The story of Narcisse Pelletier, which to me is the most engrossing, the most moving, the most terrifying, in a way, story, is completely unknown in Australia, at least until 2009, when a wonderful scholar translates a rather lost and rare French document which tells his story. It's the story of a castaway cabin boy, only 14, up in Cape York, who would have starved had he not been rescued by some wild-looking savages, so-called.
What happens next is described in that long-lost French text, 17 Years with the Savages, The Adventures of Narcisse Pelletier, as translated by Stephanie Anderson.
He was set to die of fatigue and starvation if nobody came to his rescue. But then he heard slow steps coming towards the sandy hollow. It was two men, walking with the utmost caution. One of them was horrible to behold. In any other circumstance, Pelletier would have tried to hide from his sight. But this was the moment of reckoning.
And he takes a little tin cup that he has and he offers it to them as a kind of supplication, please don't hurt me. And they put their hands out and touch him as a reassurance, we're not going to hurt you.
As Constant Merlin, the French doctor who later records his story, writes, from this moment the alliance was made. It was never to be broken. These men adopt him into their clan. They become his family and friends for the next 17 years. Bronwyn Douglas, author of Science, Voyages and Encounters in Oceania, 1511 to 1850.
It's absolutely clear that he thought of himself as being an Aboriginal man. They were his brothers, they were his fathers, they were his cousins. He felt at home amongst them, he fitted in amongst them significantly. He was clearly regarded as different. He was regarded, at least initially, as the returning spirit of his father's dead son.
It's really important to imagine how deeply he becomes naturalized, I suppose one might say. This boy has arrived at 14, and for the next 17 years, the absolute formative times of his life, he lives with the indigenous people. He forgets his own language, French, and he learns the language of Utangnanu, which is the language that the Wantala people speak in his area. For all intents and purposes, other than the fact that he's got a copper-coloured skin, he is an indigenous person. He learns to hunt, he learns to make spears, he learns to make outrigger boats, he goes fishing with his cousin. 45 kilometres out to sea is where the reef was. And they fish out there, they fish for dugong in particular. And that was the thing that made you most revered as a warrior, to be able to capture dugong and the other big fish, shark and groper, these big fish.
The people of Lockhart River, the region where Pelletier lived, still hunt dugong, turtle and rays. This is part of an interview Ian McCalman recorded with the traditional owners while working on his book, The Reef, A Passionate History.
Nora, we want to get a little bit of an understanding of this country where the boy is. He starts off Cape Direction. That's where he first
comes. Yeah, I think they found him just over Cape Direction. That's where the water area is too.
And he comes round to the camp further up.
And they walk from here further down south. Yeah. Maybe 2 to 3 days walk. People in the tribal camp were afraid of him as well. Kids were just going there pulling his hair because they showed him what food to eat, what food to hunt, kill. They went out in those little canoes to get dugong and turtle.
Dora Akum, whose people still hunt dugong as they did in the 19th century, with a spear. This was a way of life Pelletier had no intention of leaving. But in 1875, 17 years after he was abandoned by his shipmates, Pelletier found himself on board the schooner, the Brisbane, heading for Sydney. Also aboard was Lieutenant John Otley, a fluent French speaker.
I don't think we need to disbelieve Otley's account that he was kidnapped by the English traders who found him and that he was forcibly removed.
Like Oswald Brearley, who gave us Barbara Thompson's story, Otley is a sympathetic and intelligent listener.
When the pearling schooner John Bell put in at Night Island for wood and water, it was observed that there was a white man amongst the blacks. On the assumption that this white man was detained against his will and that he would naturally wish to get away, the skipper sent boats on shore with a view of trading for the white man. Eventually, they succeeded in separating him from the blacks, and having got him into one of their boats, the sailors motioned him to sit down whilst they kept the blacks off by making a show of firing their guns. As a matter of fact, Narcisse Pelletier subsequently explained to me that the men of the John Bell had quite misunderstood the state of affairs. It was true that the blacks were unwilling that he should be carried off, but it was equally true that he himself had no desire to leave the tribe. In short, his view, evidently, was that instead of being rescued, he was kidnapped on the 11th of April, 1875.
Whether down the track he would have regretted that, it's impossible to say, of course. He certainly seems to at the time, and the descriptions of him in Somerset, the little settlement at the top of Cape York, of just squatting, looking vacantly, are really very poignant. There were some accounts that he had actually tried to escape while he was at Somerset, so I don't think there's too much doubt that he was, in that vivid phrase that I think Athol Chase uses, the one of the earliest of the stolen generation.
He's sent to France, where Constant Merlin, a local doctor with an interest in ethnography, writes a book based on Peltier's experiences. It wasn't to be a first-person account, as Brearley provided in his notes of Barbara Thompson, rich in quotes and direct speech. What it is, though, is very reflective of its time. The attitudes Merlin expresses as he interprets Peltier's observations are really quite moderate for French anthropology at the time.
The language of the savages is rich in its vocabulary and the number of syllables which make up its words. However, I am far from wishing to claim that it may be compared with the language of civilized people.
And Merlin concedes certain things. Obviously, they love their children. Obviously, they have some kind of sense of morality. They share their food. They're obviously very communal. Perhaps they even seem to understand nature quite well. But his conclusion in the end is that he lived a life as a white savage, that he was for 17 years asleep in a kind of torpor.
Sir John Otley describes the man Merlin would have seen, his ear hugely distended by a wooden earplug and his chest and shoulders decorated with ritual scars.
The accompanying photograph shows what he was like in 1875. The one naked to the waist shows the bars of raised flesh on his chest and shoulders, and also the pierced lobes of his ears. He was about middle height, broad-shouldered and evidently immensely powerful. The colour of his body had been burnt by the sun to a deep red tan. As regards the bars of raised flesh on his chest and shoulders, he told me that they had been made by scratching or cutting with a sharp tool, I believe a shell, and then pinching up the flesh in front of a fire. I gathered it was a very lengthy operation and must have been very painful, but he seemed to be rather proud of the result, and we are not sure that it did not denote some sort of rank in the tribe.
But now he's back in France, where these things are not recognised as marks of beauty or pride. There's debate as to whether he was an initiated man, Bronwyn Douglas.
It's impossible to know, really, whether he was or wasn't. It probably doesn't matter. But certainly, I think he has a protective attitude. He doesn't want to put the people with whom he lived, and whom he didn't want to leave, he doesn't want to put them in a bad light. I think that's very clear.
He was extremely reticent as to his life among the blacks, and gave us little or no information when we pressed him for interesting details as to their customs, manners and beliefs.
My impression is that he doesn't resettle permanently in the village. And, of course, one gets no impression of how his poor mother received him, although she'd been in mourning for 17 years.
There is a belief that the family had him exorcised by the priest.
Yes, yes. My head's spinning at that. I can't imagine what would have induced his family to have him exorcised. One wishes one had the story from his family.
The problem is he's proud of being a savage. I mean, he has obviously mixed feelings. He's become a Frenchman again. He's probably divided in his sensibility. But he's not going to abandon the life that he led. He's not going to denounce it. He's not going to denigrate it. And that is, of course, from the point of view of the community and his family, a grave mistake. They want him to forget it. And so poor Narcisse Peltier lives this life, a genuinely lost life. neither with his original people on the sand beach nor properly integrated with his original people in the Vendée.
Peltier died in France, but for years there were rumours that he'd been seen again in Cape York.
Now for a word about the alleged return of Peltier. I do not rule this out as impossible, or even very improbable, because, as I have shown, he evidently did not want to leave the tribe. And I am now inclined to think that if the canoes we saw off the coast had belonged to his own, instead of to an enemy tribe, he would very likely have gone overboard there and then and made a dash for freedom.
What is so striking about both Peltier and Barbara Thompson is the real warmth with which they... I mean, Barbara wanted to go, but she was very, very loving about her immediate Aboriginal family and, of course, also about the mainland man who had originally saved her from the shipwreck. But similarly with Peltier, his relations, he stressed how kind they'd been, how well they treated him. I mean, Eliza Fraser is a kind of a media beat-up, isn't she?
Watering tears, I'll pledge thee. Roaring sighs and groans, I'll wage thee. Who shall say that fortune grieves him? While the star of hope she leaves him, mean a cheerful twinkle lights me. Dark despair around benights me. I'll nay blame my partial fancy. Nothing could resist my Nancy. But to see her was to love her. Love but her and love forever. Had we never loved so kindly, had we never loved so blindly, never met or never parted, we had ne'er been broken-hearted. Fare thee well, thou first and fairest, fare thee well, thou best and dearest. Thine be ilka joy and treasure, peace, enjoyment, love and pleasure. I fond kiss and then we sever. I farewell, alas, forever. Deep in heart-wrung tears I'll pledge thee. Warring sighs and groans I'll wage thee.
RN's very own Melanie Tate singing there as Barbara Thompson. On Hindsight here on RN, you've been listening to Castaway. The producer was Nicole Steinke and the sound engineer was Timothy Nicastri. Special thanks to Ian McCalman. As always, you'll find lots more information at our page on the RN website, abc.net.au/radionational. Look in the drop-down box for Hindsight. Thanks for listening today. I'm Lorena Allam. My thanks to Joe Wallace. We'll be back with you next Sunday at 1 here on RN.
Listening is a peaceful act. Listening to the silence, but more than that, listening to the other.
The thing is also that peace is around us all the time. It's here. It's just that we haven't tapped into it because violence and war is actually what the habits of our cultures are.
Wim Wenders and Mary Zanazi are Inventing Peace. That's Radiotonic. Find us anytime on the RN homepage.